This program is brought to you by Emory University.
Our third speaker this evening is Susan Healy. She's a professor in the School of Biology at the University of St. Andrews. Her interests lie in determining the role that cognition plays in the lives of animals facing real-life situations and how evolution might have shaped the cognitive abilities of those animals. Her research investigates cognitive abilities in non-model organisms, such as hummingbirds, zebra finches, bower birds. She's especially interested in animal cognition in the wild and has worked on spatial memory and food-storing birds, all sorts of cognitive abilities in hummingbirds, and more recently has become interested in understanding nest building in birds. As she put it, somewhere in there is also an interest in variation in brain size and the neural underpinnings of the cognitive abilities identified in real-life contexts.
Thanks very much, Dietz. And you're not supposed to begin talks with an apology, but I am going to apologize for the interaction that my computer did not have with your system. Anyway, here we are. And some of you may have been in the last talk or two, but one of the things that I'm here to talk to Dietz and to Dori and to Michael about is, what does building mean? What does creating mean? And here I'm going to talk a little bit about the particular building, making, creating behavior that I'm interested in, which is nest building. But I'm going to start off with just putting some words into your mind to think about. And the first one is to think about what we might mean when we talk about creating. So the use of imagination or original ideas to create something is inventiveness. To cause to exist, occur, appear is also creating, what we might describe as creating. To construct, especially when something complex, by assembling, joining materials, to build a house, to establish, increase, to strengthen, to mold, form, or create. All of these things are definitions. If you look them up, you don't have to go very far to find what it is to create. And why am I interested in that? But before we get to that, I want to thank a bunch of people and a bunch of funding agencies, none of which would have been possible without them. All the good bits belong to these guys and maybe a little bit to me, but all of the errors are mine. What I'm particularly interested in trying to understand is a behavior that's seen here, and tell me if the lights need to go down and I'll ask somebody else to sort that out. It's seen with this wren over on the left here with a stick going to build in this box. And this is a bird I just saw whilst sitting in the garden, friends of ours in Cornell. And then what I saw over the next little while, this bird doing this behavior. What does it take to make a nest? And that I got into thinking about this question because some time in the middle of the 90s, 1996, this paper was published by Gavin Hunt, where he had discovered that New Caledonian crows make tools. And this was a momentous paper. It wasn't the first time that birds had been discovered to make tools. In fact, in the 50s, woodpecker finches in the Galapagos were seen to make tools, and there was a paper published. But that paper wasn't cited at all until this work in the 1990s. So it's interesting. The history of science is an interesting progression. But this caused a huge splash in animal cognition because of the way that we think about tool use and it's special, it's something that humans do, something that some of our close relatives do, and now birds did it. And what does that mean? What does it mean in terms of evolution, in terms of cognitive ability, and so on? And the problem is that if you are interested in the evolution of cognitive abilities and you're looking at tool use, I'm going to suggest to you, and indeed it's already been said to you, that it's very uncommon across non-human animals. It's not even that common in hairy primates. More of them have been seen to do this in captivity than have been seen in the wild to do it. So here's the woodpecker finch. There's been some animals that have been suggested to make tools or use tools, and there's some invertebrates. Here's an octopus, leaf-cutting ants that do things with their the way in which they use their leaves to create mold and so on. We have otters that smash, put rocks on their chest and then smash shells on the top of the rock. And we have beavers building. Actually, we know nothing about beaver building, okay, except that they do it. And they cause these dams and all sorts of flooding issues. But if you are interested in evolution and you're going to start with this many animals, it's really hard to find out why these ones here. Why is it that some of them did it, do it, and not, and others don't? The explanations have ranged. There are all sorts of explanations, things like brain size. Bigger brains make you make tools, but actually there's lots of animals with big brains and they don't make tools. It could be they live in social groups. If you're social, you make tools, but lots of animals live in social groups and they don't make tools. It could be that you are extractive foragers and therefore you need tools to make to get your food, but there are animals that extract food. In fact, we were talking about one earlier today. The eye has, in fact, got an extremely long finger that helps them to extract food, and they didn't develop tool use in doing that. So if we're interested in what it takes to make a tool, I'm going to suggest to you we have a bunch of making stuff here where animals are potentially choosing materials. They are then modify those materials into a structure. We see a huge diversity across birds in that. So we range from species up in the top left where the animals aren't building at all to brush turkeys that are to the right of that picture. I have tools myself. Up here in Australia where the males scrape together materials into a mound and then he measures the temperature, and when it gets too cool he puts more material on. When it gets too hot for the eggs, he takes material away. There are birds that make holes in trees and build their nest in there. Some birds use mud. Some birds shape grass into structures for their eggs. Weaver birds weave. You may or may not have heard about them. Oripendulas build their nest. Each of these are built by a separate bird, but they're built in groups. And here we have a huge apartment, a nest apartment, built by sociable weavers in Africa. What we have here is a huge diversity in what animals build, the shape of what they build, the materials they use. And so if we're interested in building, making things, and the evolution of that, then birds might be an interesting group to look at that. So my question is going to be, what does it take to build a nest? Because it turns out that in spite of many, many years of looking at nests, stealing eggs from nests all over the place, they've been painted, they've been made. There's a wonderful artist in Britain called Laura Bacon who makes these things, and these are about half the size of the room. And when I have enough money, which is probably never as an academic in Britain, I want one of these in my garden. I have a garden, I just don't have one of those. They've been photographed. They've been painted, they've been made. So Bjorn Braun had an idea that I should have had, and I still don't know why I don't do this. He got zebra finches to build nests out of these materials, and then he put them in an art gallery and sold them each for 25,000 euros. Okay, could have funded all of my science. What am I thinking? And if you had all that money, there's a lot of money in this particular slide, none of which I have, then you can go and spend it by spending some time in this hotel in northern Sweden that is a bird nest. Okay, so they're in our lives, they're all over the place. In fact, they're so ubiquitous, we think we know everything about them. And we do, sort of. You can get guidebooks. No matter where you go in the world, you can get a guidebook to tell you about the bird nest in the place that you're going to. Okay, so why am I here? Good thing I cut my talk short by messing around with the technology, because we're done. We know. There we go. Here's the guidebook. I should have one up there. In fact, here we go. Here's the one for here. We're done. Okay. But I'm going to suggest to you that actually we're not done. We're not nearly done. But I better be done in 45 minutes. But I'm going to take you on a bit of a journey with how I'm going to suggest one way to understand these constructions made by birds. And I'm going to take a leaf out of Tinbergen's book. And the reason for this is because Tinbergen, who some of you may have heard of, was a Dutch ethologist and one of three men who won the Nobel Prize, the only time ever the Nobel Prize has gone to work on animal behaviour, and Nico Tinbergen was one of the winners of that. So he must have said something important. He did. He had said lots of important things, but he offered us a framework for how to understand a behaviour, any behaviour that we see. Here's a way to come at it. And we can address what are called the four whys. And the first one is, well, in no particular order actually, is why does the animal do the behavior at all? So the function of what we call the function of the behavior. We could ask what are the factors that lead to the behavior happening right then and there that we're seeing it as the animal is doing it. And these are called mechanisms. We could ask how the behavior changes with age and experience. And these are coming at the problem with a developmental eye. And finally, we can ask how the behavior has changed across evolutionary time. So that's an evolutionary kind of a question. And so that's what I'm going to try and do here, is to take each of these questions and see what we can do in terms of building. I'm going to start with genes and instinct, though, because if you ask most people, this is what all we need to know. Except if you'd asked Alfred Russel Wallace in the mid-19th century, he would have said, birds, we are told, build their nests by instinct, while man constructs his dwelling by the exercise of reason. Yet I have come to the conclusion that not only is it very doubtful, but absolutely erroneous, that it not only deviates widely from the truth, but is, in almost every particular, exactly opposed to it. I believe, in short, that birds do not build their nests by instinct. Okay, again, end of story. He said it, he was famous, and so it must be true. But if you go on Google now, and I'm sure some of you might be even close to Google, you could look up how to build a nest. And I did this when I had too much spare time last year. And in fact, there is a recipe for building an American robin nest online. You read this, and then what follows are some directions. I think there's only about six directions. Read those, and you'll end up with a nest. Perfect, okay. Again, we have the answer. And one of the reasons we might get to that conclusion is, and you've seen some of you have seen these pictures already, here are six blackbird nests that were sent to me from across by people across Britain. And actually, depending on which eyes you've got on here, you could just say they actually do look quite the same, don't they? They look pretty similar, really. There's a bit of scratchiness here or there, but they're basically the same. And indeed, I just went online and looked at, yet found another nest. Who knows where this nest comes from? Somewhere in Britain, off the internet. And that nest, too, looks a little bit like my pile of individual nests. So maybe it is true. Maybe that is what it's all about, that everything that enables an animal, all it needs is the right genes, and it will produce a nest. No self-respecting geneticist would have you say that to them, okay? They wouldn't have any behavior of any kind being completely genetic. But I'm going to try and do it here by a short anecdote, and here it is. There are three nests here, all built by a species of bird that's found at its western range in Britain, the Dartford warbler. And these nests, this is sent from a collector in Hampshire, one from Suffolk and one from Surrey. And you don't need to know much about Britain. It's very small relative to here. I'm sure it actually probably fits inside Georgia, is that right? Okay, so these are really close together, but the nests, they have a similarity in the shape. They're a cup, what we call a cup nest, but they're built by very different things. Each of these collectors would not have identified the other two nests as being built by Dartford warblers. Okay, so maybe there's a bit of something else going on. So we're going to do a bit of something else for a little while. Okay, I'm going to come back to Tinbergen and his four questions, and I'm going to start with function and this massively busy slide. But I want to say, first of all, what do we think nests are for? What is their function? We think they're for holding and protecting the eggs and the young of birds from the prevailing wind condition, or their weather conditions, sorry. And indeed, there are lots of papers out there to suggest that if you go to the north of the planet, then you find nests that are bigger and cozier, whereas if you go to more southerly bits of the northern temperate zone, then the nests are much looser and less cozy, and that's because it's colder up north than it is down south. Okay, so we've been trying to look at that because one of the problems is that has a genetic explanation too, in that the birds, and we'll just take Britain, it's not very big, but nonetheless, apparently birds that are building in Aberdeen of the same species build bigger nests where it's chilly versus those that are building in Cornwall in the south of Britain, where it's apparently quite tropical, according to people who live in the south of Britain, and the nests are very different. But it could be that the birds up north have been selected by natural selection to build those bigger nests, not that they go, oh, it's cold, I must build a nest because it's cold today or this week. So we've been trying to, in St Andrews, to look to see whether or not birds are responding to the weather conditions in which they build and build a nest appropriately. And so what we have is a species called the blue tit. They build in boxes, which is quite convenient. Here's a female. She's built her nest. She's sitting on her eggs. Outside each of these boxes, we have an eye button that's recording the temperature across all the days and from early March, before they begin building, all the way through to the leaving of the young at the end of the reproductive period. We also have them inside the box so that we can look to see the different temperatures inside and out. And here's a nest once a female has built them. And the first question we had was, we know what the temperatures are, and I'm just going to show you data from 2 years, 2016 and 2017, where we have the temperatures that are, these symbols here are the minimum temperature, and then we have the median, the average temperature, and then the maximum temperature for March, for April and May, which is when these birds are building. They don't build across the whole time. A female can build a nest maybe 6 days or maybe 2 weeks, but what we have in here too, so the ready symbols are 2016 and the bluey green symbols are 2017. In 2017, it was warmer in the same period as it had been at the year before. And the question was, what did the birds do with this temperature, if anything, when building? Well, what they did was, and here we have, this is a date essentially from where we, it's relative to the 1st of April. In 2016, what we found is they started building later than they did in 2017, okay? And we also found that they started laying later in 2016, the cooler year, than they did in 2017, the warmer year. And in this study here, in the first 2 years, we didn't find any difference in materials between the two. What the birds did was, when it was warmer, they started building earlier. So they moved when they built, not what they built, apparently. And that's really sensible if the female, if the birds are predicting when the caterpillars that they have to feed their babies are going to come. And that's all going to come further forward if it's warmer. And what we've seen since these data is that when it's cooler, and it was the following year, then the birds move back as well. So they're moving their phenology of when they build. So it didn't look like they were doing very much, but we decided this was amenable to an experimental manipulation where, birds build earlier when temperatures are warmer. And zebra finches are a tremendous lab animal for doing nest building because here's a male and there is a female somewhere in this cage. But what you can do is give zebra finches material and they will build a nest. And we have a glorious example of one built on the floor and one built all the way up to the ceiling of his cage. But what we did here, and this is work with some collaborators in Canada, where they have rooms that are temperature controlled, and we had rooms that were kept at 14 degrees and rooms that were at 30 degrees, and half of our zebra finches built their very first nest, the first nest they've ever built at this temperature, and then others that built at this temperature. And what did we see when we did that? What we saw was that if we, after they'd had their babies and everything had left, we undid the nests and we counted the pieces of string, and they used quite a lot of string to build their nests. But here are the birds at 14 degrees, and they put lots more pieces of material into their nest than the birds built, building at 30 degrees. They do change what they're doing in response to the temperature of the room they're in. Okay. Importantly, what we found, and here are the birds building at 14 degrees, and this blue line here is the temperature of the room they're in, and the birds building at 30 degrees, and the red line here is the temperature of the room they're building in. And this is how much, this is now the temperature in the nest. So we had eye buttons in the nest, and the birds at 14 degrees increased their in-nest temperature up to about 27 degrees. These birds here also increased their temperature by a few degrees, but not nearly so spectacularly. So more pieces increase the temperature in the nest. And what we have here, if we then look at the number of pieces of string and the temperature in the nest, and we look at whether or not the birds are successful, and by successful I mean whether or not they produce live young at the end of their reproductive time, is that what they, all the birds out this end, or nearly all the birds out this end, the birds that put more pieces in, increased the temperature in their nest more, were more likely to be successful. So it's a good strategy. Then we did something really foolish. And for any of those who are naive in the room to doing experimental manipulations, you should never do it again, okay? But that's what we did. We took half of the birds that had built their first nest at 14, got to build their second nest in the same room, and same for half of the birds that had built at 30. And the other half of each of those, half of the birds went from here to here and half from there to there. So cross-balanced design. Here's the result I've just shown you. At 14 degrees, the birds put more material into their nests. Okay, do it again? No, they don't. Oh, man, this is, you know, it's like, oh. We had such a nice story. What did we do that for? And so the good thing is, as when you get older in this game that we play, you should always work with smart young things, because the smart young thing, Sophie Edwards, who I worked with on this, went away, and now I don't remember quite how long she stayed away thinking about this, and then she came back and said, I can explain this, okay, and it's going to be quite a nice explanation, because what we found was that, no, they didn't build for the ambient temperature, but if we looked at what all of the birds did in the second time they built their nest, we could explain what they did based on their experience from their first time. So all of the birds who had been successful in the first nest built exactly the same nest second time around. All the birds that had been unsuccessful put more material into their nest, in their second nest, and they were more likely to be successful as a result. So now, first timers, yes, build to the temperature. Second timers go, I know something already, I'm going to use that and ignore the temperature. So that was quite fun. So more things about function, what's it for? Something more about nest building could be about signaling to your partner and telling your partner in some way that you're pretty good. And here the question was whether or not, and now we do have a female in here, and here's our zebrafinch male building, are builders affected by their partner? And yes, they are. In zebrafinches, what we can see even in the cage, okay, the cage is about this big, okay? The male, the rate at which a male builds depends on whether the female is in here. If she's in here, he builds like crazy. The minute she pops out, he slows down. And for any of you who ever have had builders at your house, this feels a bit similar. I don't think there's much in the way of sexual display going on, but it does seem to be that something about this, and whether that's the female going, I'm in the nest, hurry up, because I'm ready, or whether he sees her in the nest, he goes, I'm going to display to her while she's in the nest. We don't know which of those two explanations, but something about his building is interacting with her behavior. Okay, now we're going to switch to question number two, is mechanism. How do we explain what a bird is doing at the time the bird is doing it? And I want to tell you about some data from Southern Mast Weavers. And here, this is a nest built by one of our birds. The reason we wanted to work on these guys is because we thought we'd start complicated. That always seemed like a really good idea. But more particularly, because they build multiple nests in a season. These males build one nest. Every time they've got a female interested, then he builds a nest, the female occupies it, and then he, if he's lucky, he goes off and builds another when there's a female to build for. One of them had 22 nests, every single one of them with a female in it. That's quite successful, let me just say. But the what we might call complex nests, what does that mean? Who knows? Nine kinds of knots, and Felicity Muth was the student who did this. And what she did was these males display when they're going to build. So you can be there and you can see what they do with the very first piece of material they bring back to the branch they're going to build on. And what she did was to draw the knot, if we're going to call it a knot, and then he went away to pick up a second piece and she took it away. When he came back, this male here put this piece on here. She did it again, photographed it, took it away. He came back, he did this, photographed it, took it away. And they just did this, and then we let him build the nest. Okay, so he did get to build after this, but this was male number one at site number one, just to show you That things might be different across males at the least. Male number two at site number one, the first site for him. And again, we saw this, then he did that, then he did this, and then he did this. And here, data from the same male, but a different nest later on. This was the sequence that he did. And our very first interpretation of these data was that when the male does this and he comes back and it's not there, he does that because that didn't work, and so on around the sequence, which is great, right? Except you should always have an alternative that you should test your original beautiful idea about over. And actually, it could be that he was always going to do this. This is always not number two, and this is always not number three. And we can't tell which of those it is. And in fact, all we can tell at the moment is a slightly disappointing story about the number of loops in the nests that they build. So the males all build, all the males we had built multiple nests across the season. And what we saw across the season was the number of loops and the attachments went up. So across the season, as he builds more nests, he puts more loops into each of his knots. And whether that's because it gets windier or he learns how to attach the nest better, we're not sure. But it sure as heck didn't really seem to get at that what would look like an interesting complexity. We have yet to sort that out. Okay, so another question we might ask in terms of mechanistic, how is it that the bird builds that nest that we're seeing now? We come back to zebra finches in the lab, and here we were interested in seeing whether or not the birds learn from experience. And in this experiment, we had zebra finches, first of all, tested with two colours of the same material, brown and green, and the birds were asked which they liked. Then what we did was to put them through this experimental design. So which colour do you like, green or brown? And then once we know that, some of the birds get to build with the colour they liked. Some of the birds got to build with the colour they did not like. And having built a nest and females laid eggs, some of them were allowed to keep their eggs and raise their babies. Some of them had their eggs taken away. And again, some of them were allowed to breed, and some of them had the taken away. Babies were raised if they had babies, so on and so forth. Babies leave home. And then you give both male and female a rest, and then you bring them back together again, and you ask the male, of these two colours and material, what do you like? Okay, so apologies to those in the audience who red-green colourblind. I hope the brown and the green are somewhat different. But the key here is the first preference test. What we see is that the males had a really strong preference, and some of them really like green, some of them really like brown, but they liked whichever colour it was a lot. Here's your, and I'm not doing it as a memory test, I'm just doing it as a discrimination test here. This is what they did in the second time round. And you go, well, I don't know if that's different or not, but it sort of maybe looks like there's a bit more variation in here. And what I'm going to do is show you how we can partition that variation depending on the experience of the birds. Here we have birds that built with their preferred nest material, whether it was brown or green. And in the first, when the first preference test, if we look at the first 10 pieces they took, nearly 10 out of 10 was for brown or green. After building these ones here, there's a bit of a diminishment, but there's nothing significant, okay? They're basically, the preference is intact after they breed. Whether they're successful or whether they're unsuccessful, it doesn't matter, okay? They'd stick with the same colour. But we did see a difference here between in the birds that built with their non-preferred nest material colour, and it was here. So the birds that built with the colour they did not like switched their preference second time round. So if they didn't like green, and we made them build with green, and they raised babies, and when you gave them green and brown the following preference test, then they really liked green. So whichever colour it was, if they were successful with their unpreferred colour, then they switched. They learned, they seem to have associated that colour with success. And we asked a similar question, but now we looked at the functional aspects of the material, and this is where the material is either what we call stiff or floppy. These are technical terms. And the technical way of telling whether something's stiff or floppy is to get a nail and put your string over the top of it, and the stiff stuff doesn't bend very much, and the floppy does quite a lot. Here are the beautiful nests they build. I'm sure I could sell these for 25,000 euros. Okay, so what we found, though, was that if you give birds variation in the experience they have with these materials, if they have no experience of these materials before, then they quite like the stiff, this is how much they like the stiff string, and where this is chance, they quite like it, okay? So they've never seen strings before, and they quite like the stiffer string. If they have one experience, and here is where they build with 100 pieces of flexible string, and then you give them the choice between flexible and stiff, they like the stiff even more. And then if they have to build a whole nest with the flexible string, that there's 100% no variation, okay? Absolutely nothing doing with the flexible string. They don't like the flexible string if they've had to build a nest with it. And why is that? That's because if you count the number of pieces of string that they use to build a nest, and the birds building with flexible strings are over 800 pieces to build a nest, whereas the birds building with stiff string are using something like 600 pieces. It takes many more pieces to build a nest if you're building with flexible string than it does if you're building with stiff string. So they don't really like costly materials. Okay. So just one, I think this is just last one, and this has come back to my original photo showing you that picture of a wren building with materials, and the question here is whether they choose materials appropriate to the task. Doesn't look like it here. So my student, Felicity Muth, who of the Southern Master Weavers, decided she wanted to do this experiment. She got some birds to build in a box that with an aperture this big, or in a box that was this big. And she gave them materials where the material was pieces of hay that were bound together with wire, where the piece of wire was 10 centimetres, if I can get 10 centimetres, or 3 centimetres. And she put these piles of materials in front of the birds and said, you choose to build with these materials, or you build with these materials, do you have a preference? And, oops, wrong computer, idiot. Okay, so slightly busy slide. They had 3 days of experience. What we have here in these two bars are the birds that are building in the boxes with a large aperture. And up here is the preference for one material over the other, and in particular the preference for the pieces with a long material. And here, so out of 10 pieces of material they take to the nest, what we see is that they are completely indifferent. They take just as many long pieces as they take short pieces into the nest. That's not true and that's true across, so here and here, across all 3 days, nothing changes for these guys. They're just totally indifferent to the materials they've got in front of them. The birds that are building in the nest with the boxes with a small aperture, though, on day one, they really don't like those long pieces of the pieces with the long bits of wire. By day two, that's sort of diminishing, and by day three, they're again completely indifferent. But still, they haven't changed the size of the aperture. They are now taking all of the pieces of material into the nest. And the reason that they're doing that and able to do that is they've changed how they're holding the piece of material. They were at the beginning holding the material in the middle, so it's sticking out like this, and that obviously doesn't go in very well. By the end of the day three, they're holding the materials at the end, so the material is running down the length of their body and they can take the whole lot in. It's a very ugly looking nest, but they try. And they've learned how to hold this stuff such that they can use it all. And then they're not restricted as to the pieces of material. Okay, I do have one final one on a mechanism. How is it? And the reason I want to talk about this one is because social learning is something that people ascribe as being something more human-like, more complicated than learning through one's own experience. And what we have here is we have a demonstrator and an observer pair where the observer male has been asked whether he likes pink or orange material. And again, they have really strong preferences. And some of them really like pink and some of them really like orange. In this case here, this is a male who really liked pink. So he got to watch a male that was building with orange material. He could see both pink and orange. What he didn't know is the pink's been tied down, so the demonstrator can only take the orange, but is building with orange material. We have two kinds of observer, and the observer, and this is just the design here, basically what we have is some of these observers here are watching a demonstrator they know, and some of them are watching, so they are from the same group, and some of them are watching an unfamiliar male. They don't know who this individual is. And what we see here, before the demonstration, this is how much they like the colour that's being demonstrated to them. After the demonstration, the males that are watching an unfamiliar male still pretty much like the colour that they liked before. If they liked orange, they still like orange, even if they've seen pink demonstrated. But the birds that are watching somebody they know build with a colour they don't like, when you give them the option after watching that, they switch their preference. And if they liked pink, then watch somebody they know building with orange, and you give them the option again, they're massively into the orange. So they copy the choice, but only if they know the bird. Okay, how about development? Question number three. And this is going to compress all of Alexis Breen, PhD student in the lab's work into three slides actually, but one experiment where she was interested in trying to, during development, see what birds might be learning about nests. And here we have birds that either hatched into an orange nest or into a pink nest. They have some experience as juveniles when they're just fiddling around, growing up, and they're either with a male, two males together and just an empty cage, two males together with an adult male, two males together with, for the males that had been in an orange nest, they get to play with pink material on their own or pink material and an adult. And the opposite experiment, if they had been hatched into a pink nest, then they got orange material at this option. And then they turn into adults almost immediately if they're a zebra finch. You give them a female, a box, and some material and say, okay, what do you want to build with? And it turns out that here, this is the experience with material, and they've either got an adult and material, no adult and material. Kind of doesn't matter. The key is here. Is the preference for natal material none, zero. So no matter which of those manipulations they're in, they don't particularly like the colour of the material of the nest they hatched into. But the boys that had material when they were juveniles, now the males that had an adult in with them prefer the colour of the material of that they manipulated when they were juveniles. It's important that they had an adult. And we can talk about what that might be. It's not about the adult males doing a lot of manipulating the material, but the presence of the male really changes what they learn about that material. Okay, so as I said, that's Alexis Breen's PhD, done in a minute and a half. She'd be horrified. Fortunately, she's not here. Hopefully, she doesn't hear this recording either. Question number four, evolution. Okay, how about across evolutionary time? How is it that we get from one nest to another? This is the phylogeny of birds wrapped up into a beautiful display. And here is just some crazy, looks like a weaver bed nest, of the possible ways you could go from here to any of these. And actually, we don't know the answer. Okay, there are some people currently, the lead is in Bristol at the moment, is trying to explain this across all birds. So what I'm going to do is just tell you about some birds, and this is a group of babblers, a species of bird that are building in Southeast Asia in particular, and where we looked at nest design and where they build. And here we're interested in birds that build their nests on the ground and birds that build their nests off the ground, and then what they build. So some of them build a cup nest and some of them build a dome on top of their nest. And so these are squares filled in or not, circles filled in or not. Here is part of the phylogeny. Simple to say, what I want to say here is they vary. So some do one and not the other. And if you really want to spend time, you can see that we've matched up a whole lot of stuff. Give it to somebody who knows how to do phylogenetic analyses. And what we found was that if we look at the data for the birds that build cup nests across these species and those that build dome nests, and then look at how high off the ground they're building, what we see is that birds that build cup nests build much higher off the ground than birds that build domed nests. And it looks like what's going on here is the dome is there to reduce predation risk. Here we also looked at evolutionary transitions. So here are the two most common phenomena. Here's the states. So here's the domed on the ground, and here's the cup and the tree. And what we see across evolutionary time is that there have been times when this has occurred, an off-ground domed nest or an on-ground cup nest, but they don't last there very long in evolutionary time. They go to the, one of the other states very quickly in evolutionary time, so such that we end up with the two stable states here. So we can start to get an understanding across species as to why they build the nest they do this way too. Okay, so what does it take to build a nest? Loads. Partner, environmental condition, local physical structure. They learn about reproductive success. They pay attention to behavior of familiar individuals. They pay attention to the structural features of the materials, experiments on young, blah, blah, blah. Here's just, I want to show you some structures that are built by a species other than birds, variation in them. But I want to come back to my picture I showed you before of the Dartford warblers and give you, we have a clue as to how to explain the variation that we're seeing in these birds across these different parts of Britain. And what we've done is looked at some GIS data of the environments around where these birds' nests have been taken, and we can see what the material composition of the nests are here and the habitat compositions of the birds. So by and large, we can explain what is going on here by the environment in which these birds are building. The birds in Hampshire, these birds here are in a very grassy environment, so they use grass. These birds here are in a much more heathery environment, they use heather. So what does it take to build a nest? In this case, it's the environment in which the birds are using and potentially the right kinds of material in order to get into that structure. And I want to finish with The only bit of this three here that that I really am talking about in this talk is a bit of collaboration, maybe culture. I'm going to say that word. But I'm going to start off with a collaboration. And this is with Andy Young, who has been working on this species here. It's a white-browed sparrow weaver in the Kalahari. And he has a study site here, 2 kilometres by 2 kilometres, in which there are 40 family, roughly family groups designated by here. I work with a couple of wonderful slash lunatic women, Lauren Gillette and Maria Tejo Ramos. It's nice and warm. This is not Scotland. But what these birds do is they build structures. And I'm showing you two of, this is a roost, and you can see two holes here. One of the holes is the entrance to this, and the other is the exit. And they build lots of them. They also build a nest, which looks very like this, except one end is closed over. And the reason we went to look at these birds and what they were doing with their nest building is that the story is that the dominant pair build the nest together. And so the question was, how did they do that? How do they coordinate what they're doing to build something that works in terms of a roost or a nest? But it turns out that you should be careful what people tell you about what we know about animals, because it's supposed to rain, the birds build like crazy, that's a technical term. And it turns out that it rains and they don't build, they lay eggs and they have babies and feed their babies. So we went and measured the structures, because we could do that, there were structures there, we went and measured them. And so what we did was to measure everything we could about them, and this is just to show you all of the things that we measured. And the reason we could measure these and find some interesting, well, to think about what was going on, every family, even though the family is 3 to 6 individuals, they'll have something like 2 dozen structures in their, in the trees that they defend. And so what we can do for each one, and here are 11 colonies, families, and what we could do was look at the length, of the, this is the width, sorry, of the this bit here, and the length of this structure here. And what we found was that for each family, there's a family signature. The length of these and the width of these structures is varies across the colonies, but it's reliable within a family as to the dimensions of these parts. Other parts of the structure are also repeatable. And again, within a family, it looks like there's family signatures to what's going on. We have looked, so here is a, here's the desert, and the coloured dots are some of the families that we have in this analysis. And this is the kind of variation that we're talking about across these structures. If you look at the trees, it looks like they've got sort of Dr. Seuss structures in them, and they all look the same. But if you get a ruler out, they're not the same. What we know in terms of explaining why they're different, how they're different, We have looked at distances between colonies, and here is just four analyses on different, different measurements, and to say that there is some explanation for what we see in terms of the distance. So the further they are, the more different they are. But actually, it's almost explaining not very much. It's explaining about 30, maybe 40% of the variation. And one question we have here is whether or not this is because the birds are copying and that there's a variation that we might see if we can understand where the genealogy, mapping where the birds are to their family structures, to their family, not to the distance that they are amongst them. Okay, so now I want to finish and way longer than hold you way into the night, more longer than I meant to. I want to come back to the original point of this, was to how do we understand what animals make? And I want to claim that to understand structure, we need to know the something about the builder. We need to do something about building itself, the behavior, and the context in which they're building. And I want to show you a bit of variation. Michael suggested to me, but this is all cultural. But actually, maybe, there might be a little bit of that in Bird's Nest and a little bit more than we thought about before. Thanks very much. If there are any questions, yeah, sure. Hey, Rob.
So I love all this, what they learn. You know, they're picking the color, they're picking this thickness, and these are, they're showing some experience and changes. But then, you know, you set up the whole problem is like, oh, geneticists would never want us to think that it was an instinct. But yet we have these species typical nests, so you can kind of recognize a nest sometimes at least. Right, to get these guides. So how are you thinking about those two pieces that there is, what is the mechanism that's driving the bird to produce a certain shape, say the dome or the cup, versus what materials it chooses to use and dimensions and such?
So I don't know, but I'm going to speculate, and that could be rampant. Two things. One is that the way to get similarity across generations could be genetic, so some innate. Another way to do it is by copying, and that's what we think of song learning. So actually song learning has two components to it. It has an innate component, and that might be about who young birds pay attention to while they're young. And then we get this huge variation across birds too, right? There are some species that learn one song, but they learn the song. Everybody learns their song, but some species learn one and some learn hundreds of songs, and how and why they do that, we don't know, actually. We still don't know that. So it is possible that some of this is because they are copying some part of what's going on. And Alexis also did do an experiment where she had birds that, instead of watching a familiar or a conspecific building, she just had a nest in the cage next door of the other colour, and the birds that have seen a nest, nothing going on, are more likely to switch, as to become indifferent as to the colour they like. So it could be that they are paying attention, and you could get some similarity that way. Whether or not, I'm going to go all out and say you could, that could explain the whole lot. And if it was humans, that is how we explain generational behavioural. Probably not. There was something else I was going to say. Oh, and well, another thing is too, I think that again, similarity, when we say we can see a blackbird nest as a blackbird nest as a blackbird nest, if you go and measure them, they're hugely variable. So the blackbird nests I got sent from across the country, 150 of them, they varied in weight from 60 grams to 600. Okay. Yes, they sort of all look the same, but they're way more variable than we look and than we notice until we measure. And I think there's a lot of variation we're missing. And the final thing, the final thing is that it could be that they are imprinting, if not on the colour, on some other attribute. So our zebra finches in the lab, zebra finches typically build a domed a dome on their nest. And some of the birds don't do that. When we covered the top of the cages of the birds, what we found there, the nest cup is sitting halfway up the cage wall, is that birds built all the way up to the ceiling of the cage, and that was their roof. They actually built a tall cup nest with no dome on it at all. And whether that's because the material was really hard to make a dome, and this is how they did it. But, I mean, that's anecdotal, but we had lots of birds doing it. So is that because they wanted something dark, and that's how they were going to get it? I don't know. Clever experiments, that's what we need. Clever students, that's what we need. Well, not just students, but that's where we start. Yeah, don't worry. So not brain size, cerebellar foliation and how foliated. So cerebellum is folded, as most of you maybe all of you know. But across birds, the degree to which the cerebellum is folded varies. We did a very simple analysis, and we're simply looking at what kind of nest the birds built, whether they built a nest at all, whether they built a cup nest, or whether they built a domed nest. The gradation of those different types of nest structure correlates with the variation in foliation. So the more complicated the nest, the more foliated the cerebellum of the species that builds it. The parrots. In that group, we don't think we had any parrots. I don't know that we've got, we used the data that Andrew Wanier had published, and I'm not sure there are parrots in there. No. So, and tell me more about parrots that you'd...
Well, they are quite manipulative, speculative,
yeah.
And
manipulative.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
So,
yes, that's right. In fact, as people here, and last time I was here, I talked to a couple of people who were working on the function of the cerebellum in birds. But we know even less about the cerebellum in birds and what it's doing than we do about behaviour of building. But that is a good prediction. We should look. So getting the data is quite hard because lots of people like the birds alive, behaving, and don't like them dead. So it's a real issue with people who want to put that into, you know, the other stuff. As you probably know, primate people are one or the other, by and large. Yeah, Deets. So I'm going to give you a bit of anecdotage to answer that question. We've seen three different ones. One is, actually these are not anecdotes, what we saw across the season in our southern mast weavers is that by the end of the season they're dropping material much less, so in terms of their ability to hold on to the material and so on, or maybe to choose it. But as juveniles, we've seen in the Cape weavers, young males will come in to what a male is building, to the structure a male is building, and look like they're just kind of ripping bits off it. That doesn't really look like practice in the way that we would see practice. But we also see those same males, those same adult males now in Cape weavers, you'll see building, and they I've got to resist trying to do it, but they pull two branches together and weave the grass such that the two branches are pulled together, and then they weave a hanging nest from that onto that structure. And what you see sometimes is they're building something that looks perfectly fine, and then all of a sudden they start ripping it up themselves. All the material, sometimes all the way back to the two empty, two clean branches, and then they'll start again. Other times they just go back to the attachment and then start again from there. So it's as if there's something wrong somewhere in what they've done, and they're going to take it back to the stage they think is okay. But the practicing, I think there's going to be some practicing at least and holding material, picking it up and doing something with it, but we haven't got any data on that yet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be hard. So what I want to get at is sort of the difference between deliberate practice that's directed towards developing a skill, sometimes attention and changing who you are, versus something that's immediately rewarding, versus something that would be characterized as behavior.
Yeah. That's right. No, exactly. And I think also, I think it's important to choose the species as well. And it's a bit like if we think about humans, okay, we think of humans as being a species that's all the same and whatever. But actually, there's a lot of foraging groups on our planet still who have not developed these things at all. Not just the use of them. They don't use them. They didn't invent them. They don't have them. So not all humans end up making these things, and you know, so even, and I think it's probably going to be true too that across bird species there will be different things going on in different species, and we should expect to see that, and not just use one bird as saying, if we find it here, here we go, we've explained everything in birds. So, and I would say that maybe, but I think that's probably a realistic. There's some birds that don't build nests. Cuckoos. Brood parasites, right? Cuckoos, female cuckoos lay their eggs in somebody else's nest. They don't do any of the building. They still have to recognize what a nest looks like because they can't just dump their eggs wherever. They have to put them, and they have to put them in the nest of the right species as well. So, again, it's getting at the right example to ask the question. So, yeah, maybe a long-lived species. What should I? Yeah. 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 Needing
right,
drink.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.